All right. Acts chapter 7. Now, remember what happened in Acts chapter 6 is that we were introduced to individuals that were selected to help widows that were being neglected in the daily distribution. And Stephen was one of those selected. We also learned that Stephen was a very capable preacher and speaker, and one couldn't answer his arguments. And so when you can't answer someone, you basically rough them up a little bit. And that's kind of what took place as they seized him, it says in verse 12, and stirred up the people. And essentially he's brought before the Sanhedrin, the high priest, the council, all of them that would have been there at the time of Jesus. And they now are listening to Stephen. And Stephen in Acts chapter 7 begins his defense, or his sermon, it's been called. Some have entitled this "History Repeats Itself," and I think that's probably a pretty good title to the lesson, if you were to give one. Because that's the thrust of his lesson, that what's being done now is what had been done before. And he started off by talking about the common ground, their common father with Abraham in verse 2 of Acts chapter 7, and how God had told him that he needed to get out of your country and from your relatives and come to a land that I'll show you, verse 3. And then he came out of the land of the Chaldeans and dwelt in Haran. And from there, when his father was dead, he moved him to this land in which you now dwell. And so God had promised Abraham, we mentioned this also as well on Sunday, this threefold promise, a land promise, a nation promise, and through his the seed promise. Through his seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. And so God was putting his plan into action through Abraham, but Abraham had to accept it by faith. A lot of these things he would not see in his lifetime. But he eventually, in time, at his old age, had a child, verse 8. Then he gave him the covenant of circumcision. And so Abraham begot Isaac and circumcised him on the eighth day. And Isaac begot Jacob, and Jacob begot the 12 patriarchs. So he begins to tell the Jewish story. Now, one thing he mentioned was that Isaac was circumcised. That could have been a detail that was left out. The story would have been just fine. But remember, one of the charges against Stephen was that he was putting down the law, the customs, putting down Moses, putting down God, and the temple and the holy place. And so you'll see scattered throughout Stephen's lesson little slight answers to those charges. Little details here and there to show that this is something he recognizes is true, legitimate, and something that was important and noteworthy as well. And by no means is downgrading or casting aspersions upon these particular practices under the old covenant. So that kind of brings us up to speed as we left off there in verse 8. Did anyone have any comments about the first part about Abraham? Okay, if not, then we're going to pick up in verse 9 with Joseph. And the patriarchs, becoming envious, sold Joseph into Egypt. But God was with him and delivered him out of all his troubles and gave him favor and wisdom in the presence of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and made him governor over Egypt and all his house. So, in two verses, Stephen covers a number of decades that take place in Joseph's life. Can anyone recall why it is that Joseph was envied by his brothers? That's right. And how did he show that favoritism? Very good, Tiffany. That's right. He had a coat of many colors on. And so every time they'd see him, they'd see the father's love and favoritism. Why else? Go ahead.
Plus, he was a dreamer.
That's right. Now, what did those dreams say?
He said that he dreamed that I think the sheaves bowed down to him. And so they was hot about that. And no doubt, when they sold him off, they was thinking, all right, dreamer, what happens to your dream now? Bye-bye. No love.
That's right. They did not like those dreams. And even the father kind of was a little put off by it. Even me and your mother will bow down to you. But the difference was the father, you know, kept it in his heart. He was thinking about it, whereas the brothers just saw it red when they heard those things.
And another thing that shows us about a parable, everything in a parable you cannot riddle out. It said his mother. And his mother, guess what? What part of that field? She was dead, kind of thing. So you can't do everything in a parable and make it literal, everything literal. It's just an overview of what's going to happen.
That's right. And that's God was trying to convey a thought with that. And now, what is an interesting parallel is that when they do see the brother Joseph again, they're looking for, right, grain, which comes from wheat, barley, you know, all these things. And so there is some details that are interesting how they do parallel, but you're right. And not every detail is to be interpreted.
And they were bowing down at that time.
They were bowing down.
Severe.
That's right. That's right. Brother? That's right. Now, with Joseph being sent to Egypt, we know that it's quite some time before he's actually elevated to second in command. In fact, he's got to go through a whole bunch of hardship before he gets elevated. But God has a plan. God's going to do this at the right time. And so Joseph has to go through the school of hard knocks, and then eventually in the right time, God exalts him out of prison and is able to interpret the dream that Pharaoh has. So there in verse 11, now a famine and great trouble came over all the land of Egypt and Canaan, and our fathers found no sustenance. But when Jacob heard that there was grain in Egypt, he sent out our fathers first. And the second time, Joseph was made known to his brothers, and Joseph's family became known to Pharaoh. And Joseph sent and called his father Jacob and all his relatives to him, 75 people. So Jacob went down to Egypt and he died, he and our fathers, and they were carried back to Shechem and laid in the tomb that Abraham brought for a sum of money from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem. And so here we see the rest of the story, that in time God used this to bring the lineage of Abraham out of Canaan and into Egypt. That was for a reason. In Canaan, we learned that they were starting to intermix with some of the Canaanites. You see that in the story with Judah and Tamar. And so God knows that he's got to move them to a place where no one would want to mix with them. The Egyptians, they do not even want to spend time with someone that's a shepherd. That's an abomination to them. And so that would allow them the isolation in Goshen to be able to perpetuate a people and become a nation in time. But before you get there, you first just have, through the providence, they're hungry, realizing there's grain in Egypt. Let's go to Egypt. And it just so happens to be, right, by the providence of God, that the brother Joseph is in charge and can make all these things take place. Now, what kind of character did Joseph have to have to make this happen? Prideful or humble? That's right. Vengeful or forgiving? That's right. Humble and forgiving is the character of Joseph. So he had to be the right person for this to happen. Not just anybody from the family put in that position. It had to be the right person. Joseph was that person. God knows the hearts. And so Joseph is in the right place at the right time. Now he does cause the brothers to reflect on what they had done. Right? and put them through a little bit of a ringer themselves to learn a lesson of what it'll be like to lose the next youngest brother, right? Or actually, it would have been the youngest brother. But you see a change of heart there with Judas saying, no, take me instead. Take me. I cannot do this to my father. I already did it to him one time. I will not do it again. And so, lesson learned. They had also become humble through the process of time and their guilty conscience. So, everything came together at the right time and place. And Stephen shares this bit of history as well, trying to develop the Hebrew nation as to why God is going to have the plan He has in the Christian dispensation. Comments, questions about Joseph?
No matter how hard life was for him at the beginning and how difficult people turned against him, but God was with him. And we need to remember that ourselves. Sometimes life can be very difficult and hard. But as long as you're trying to God, He's not going to forsake you.
That's right. He'll see it through.
When you said abomination, did you say that because he would, is it because he served God, or?
No, the Egyptians did not. The certain idols that they had, that they worshiped, would elevate certain animals, to idol status, and other animals to dirty, unclean, defiled animals. And so anybody that was a shepherd was one that was dealing with sheep, and that was considered one of those animals. And so the Egyptians just didn't have any close association with one that was a shepherd. And so, but the term that the Bible uses, that the Egyptians saw anyone that was a shepherd as an abomination. That was just a biblical term that was used there. Good question. Anybody else? Alrighty. Oh, go ahead.
Joseph and Stephen got the same amount, so to speak, of humility. Joseph could have given it to his brothers, but he didn't. Stephen, even though they were killing him, stoning him to death, he still had love for them.
That's right. That's right. Both were humble. Both were seeking for forgiveness of the others that were the offending party. It's good. Good parallel. Anybody else? All right. So next he talks about Moses, verse 17. But when the time of the promise drew near, which God had sworn to Abraham, the people grew and multiplied in Egypt. Now, so the promise that he's talking about here is that now God had developed a people, right? A people who grew and multiplied in Egypt. The promise now of giving them a land, right? A land in which they should dwell. As this time draws near, they had multiplied, and now God was ready to do something with them, to move them. We also learn from the Genesis account, there was another side of the coin to this time element. And that is that the people that were in Canaan land at this time, while they were evil, God was patient with them. And He says their iniquity or their sins are not yet full. And so in His patience, He continued to allow them more time. But as the nation of Israel would grow and multiply and would eventually be put in that land, God would tell them, I'm moving the Canaanites out of the land because of all these abominations. So that's part of this time equation as well. When the time of the promise drew near, God had been patient with those people, and now His patience is done. Time to move them out and move the Israelites in. So, after that, we see verse 18. Till another king arose who did not know Joseph. This man dealt treacherously with our people and oppressed our forefathers, making them expose their babies so that they may not live. At this time, Moses was born, and was well pleasing to God, and he was brought up in his father's house for 3 months. And so here we see we're introduced then to Moses, and we see a great turn of events that take place, because Joseph was loved by Pharaoh, but over the course of 400 years, you know, there's been a number of other pharaohs that have come into play. Now arises one that didn't have that kind of affinity for the Hebrew people and was content to make them slaves. And as they continue to multiply, worrisome that maybe they will overpower or revolt against the Egyptian army, against the Egyptian nation, he sought to begin to, I guess in other words, to enact population control. He was not going to allow them to continue to produce male children. And so he ordered that they be executed. But we learn of Moses' parents, Amram and Jochebed, that they feared God. They were not going to commit this sin of murdering an innocent child. So what did they do? How did they get around that? They did. But not by himself, right?
In a basket.
There you go, that's right. They put him in a basket, right. And it was lined with, you know, pitch so that it might be able to float. And there he was for some time, right? And then eventually we learned that the cries of the baby is heard. And Pharaoh's daughter finds this basket. Comments so far? So let's read on then, verse 21. But when he was set out, Pharaoh's daughter took him away and brought him up as her own son. And Moses learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was mighty in words and deeds. Okay, so in these two verses, it just summarizes some things that take place. And we know that Pharaoh's daughter finds the child, but then asks one, you know, is there a Hebrew slave that can nurse this child? And that's right. Who is it, Thomas?
The mother.
Very providentially, again, it all comes together. So Jochebed is able to essentially wean Moses. And just as we do our children, we train them, we teach them, we talk to them about the Bible, we talk to them about, you know, who they are, where they came from, and all the things that are truly important. You can imagine Jochebed doing the same if she feared God, and the Bible says she did. And so little Moses is getting the right foundation at the right time in his life, so that when he's handed over to Pharaoh's daughter, he already has the right foundation. And then Pharaoh's daughter goes on to give him the instruction in secular instruction, we might say, the ways of the Egyptians. And he would become very mighty in words and deeds. Does that strike anyone as a little odd? Okay, that's right. When he got older, he said, please send somebody else. I just am slow of tongue. I trip over my tongue. And we don't know all the details, but you do have to wonder if perhaps in his youth he did have these abilities, but when things didn't happen the way he thought it would, that he lost a lot of confidence. That can happen to preachers, elders, anyone that's in a teaching position, that if they do their best, try their best, but yet for some reason doesn't have the desired result, it's really easy to think, man, I just didn't know what, I guess it was on me. And imagine having 40 years of thinking that, so that by the time he's asked to go, he doesn't have any of that pride of being mighty in words or deed. It's quite the opposite into the spectrum.
It could possibly also be the difference in Egyptian language, which he grew up that way, mm-hmm. versus the Israel language, the Jews language. So in Egyptian language, he could have been fluent, being there raised and having all of this to us in his own language, he wouldn't have a tutor for that because the Egyptian wouldn't go for that because he was going to be the king of Egypt or in that line of defense, so descent. So that's a possibility as well.
You make a good point too, and also it highlights another skill that he would have been bilingual, so that he would be a good person to talk both to Pharaoh and to the Hebrews, and to discuss between parties what is taking place. Anybody else?
One of the accusations against Stephen was in chapter 6, verse 11, that he spoke words against Moses. And in this verse 20 of this chapter, he says, "At this time Moses was born and was well pleasing to God." So that was a false accusation that he answered, because he spoke well of Moses.
That's right. And so that's, like we were saying, you know, subtly along the way, he is showing that those charges are baseless and that he actually had a lot of respect and regard for Moses and God and the law and the tabernacle. So he goes on to say, verse 23, "Now when he was 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel." So, again, he knew that there was something that he was supposed to do, most likely from his mom and dad and the training that he got as a child. It came in his heart that he needed to rise up, visit his brethren. Verse 24, "And seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended and avenged him who was oppressed and struck down the Egyptian. For he supposed that his brethren would have understood that God would deliver them by his hand. But they did not understand." So there's some good and bad about part of this, if you think about it. The good is that he, as we read in Hebrews chapter 11, chose to be willing to suffer afflictions with the people of God. He was going to choose the Hebrew side because that was God's side, even though they were the slave side. And he was hoping to lead the people out in some way, somehow cause a revolt, that they'd rise up and follow his leadership. And that enters the bad side, and that is that he didn't wait for the go from God. You know, sometimes that's the problem. You know, people have, you know, all the zeal, but it's not according to knowledge. They're not waiting for the go from God. And so they do something without God's approval, without his authority. And so Moses here acted a little bit too early. Now, from his standpoint, it's just the right time, right? He's 40 years old, he's young, he's strong, he's quick with his wit and his words. But God doesn't want to do it now. And he's going to choose a different type of Moses to lead people out. As often God does, he chooses the one with the weaker appearance, so that there's no mistaking who's the one that really is doing the delivering and leading out. It's God. There is the strength in weakness. Comments about this particular occasion here. All right. Well, we find out in verse 26, "The next day he appeared to two of them as they were fighting and tried to reconcile them, saying, 'Men, you are brethren. Why do you wrong one another?' But he who did his neighbor wrong pushed him away, saying, 'Who made you a ruler and a judge over us? Do you want to kill me as you did the Egyptian yesterday?'" So with that, Moses knew that the word was out. And he also realized he didn't have the intended reaction that he wanted, and that is that everybody would begin to follow him. Now he will have the Egyptians against him, and he'll have the Hebrews against him. He's a man on an island with nobody on his side. And so we see the Bible tells us, verse 29, "Then at this saying, Moses fled and became a dweller in the land of Midian, where he had two sons." And when 40 years had passed, well, let's just pause right there. So he runs to Midian, right? And how does he eventually have two sons? Remind me of the story.
Doesn't he get married?
Okay, he does get married. And whose daughter is she? That's right, Jethro's. Jethro's daughter. Or Reuel is another form of his name. And then through this daughter, remember her name?
Zipporah.
Who said it?
Zipporah.
Yes, Zipporah. Mm-hmm. Then two sons are born to Moses. Okay, and so they have this new life, right? This new family life. I mean, it's by 40 years, Egypt is long gone in the rearview mirror. And he probably would have been content to live out the rest of his life, right? In Midian, being now a shepherd. But now God says it is time to go. Verse 30, and when 40 years had passed, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire in a bush in the wilderness of Mount Sinai. When Moses saw it, he marveled at the sight. And as he drew near to observe, the voice of the Lord came to him, saying, I am the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses trembled and dared not look. Then the Lord said to him, take your sandals off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. I have surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt. I have heard their groaning and have come down to deliver them. And now come, I will send you to Egypt. This Moses whom they rejected, saying, who made you a ruler and a judge, is the one God sent to be a ruler and a deliverer by the hand of the angel who appeared to him in the bush. So there's the mighty burning bush scene and how that forever changed Moses' world and all the Hebrews' world as well. The nation that God had developed in Egypt. And God gave him very explicit commands. This is the time. You must go. And you must take my people out of Egypt. What's interesting is that it mentions verse 33, how the Lord said, take off your sandals from your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. Why would that be interesting? That, again, that could have been a detail that in this narrative of Hebrew history could have been left off and you still could have told the story. But what does this little detail tell you about God and His place of worship? That's right. Okay. So was it in some way putting down Jerusalem or the holy place there because there's some other place that God said is holy ground? No. Not at all. And so Stephen is masterfully showing, very subtly showing, that your concept of holy ground, your concept of a building which is the temple of God, while yes, it is holy, your concept that this is the only place that can be holy, by someone that you revere like Moses, God had told to take off your sandals in a whole different place. Because the truth is, wherever God is, that is holy. And He's slowly building this case that it's not disrespectful at all to say that the church is holy. To say that the church can be here, there, or anywhere and God be worshipped and that that be a holy place and a holy occasion as well. Because God has had other places that He considered holy before. So little details like this, He's put in this particular lesson. And Moses, whom they rejected, saying, who made you ruler and judge, is the one God sent to be a ruler and a deliverer or a judge. So, what you see so far is you see Joseph, who was a deliverer of his brothers and his family, not readily accepted at first. What you see with Moses, who was a ruler and a judge over them, not accepted by his people at first. Do you see the parallel? Right? Because Stephen wants to talk to them about Jesus Christ. who is a ruler and a judge, but also not accepted by his people first. So, who's the one that's really running the parallel of history? Who's the one that's actually doing what the others have done before in the past and rejecting deliverers that have been sent to them? Is it Stephen? Or is it the Sanhedrin, the Jews? It's them, right? It's them. And he's making this case, showing that from history, oftentimes that change was bucked at. It was frowned on, you know. Nobody really likes change per se. And yet, God would at times initiate it. And those that accepted it were favorable to God. Those that rejected it were rejecting God. Look at Abraham. The first illustration that he shares in his lesson. Abraham was asked to change. To change everything. And he went. He did not reject God. He accepted God. And so because of that, God said, I will make a nation based off of you, from your seed. But it didn't always work out that way for the people. They often rejected what God would say to do. Comments, questions about any of this?
Like going back to the burning bush, I don't know why it popped in my head, but like, you know, it also says that two of them are gathered.
Where two or three are gathered together in my name, there I am in the midst of them.
Right, so that just popped in my head when you said, like, about the burning bush.
That's right.
Because it really doesn't matter where you are. You could be in the desert, you could be in the middle of an ocean. As long as you have faith and you're there, then there is God. And I think you have to take off the shoes, because in the midst of God, no matter where God is, that is only a holy place.
Right. What you see there is a seriousness for the occasion and reverence for the one that is there. So there's no silliness, there's no frivolousness taking place. It's all about God and not about us, right? He's the deity, he's the divine one, and we are his creatures. And so it's an appropriate way to show that we understand our place and we understand his place. That's right. Yes, Brother Ross.
And another thing is, God had already prophesied to Abraham that his descendants was going to go into a strange nation and be punished there because they were hard-headed, they were stiff-necked, they were making their own gods, they were doing their own things. And God said, I'm going to leave them down there for four generations, and then I'm going to bring them out. So this is fulfilling what he wanted to do. So even in that, as another parallel to Stephen, they were hard-headed, stiff-necked, and God dealt with them. And these people that he's telling this to, same way, because they're going to kill him, you know.
Right, right. True, good. Anybody else? So there he says in verse 36, he brought them out after he had shown wonders and signs in the land of Egypt and in the Red Sea and in the wilderness 40 years. This is that Moses who said to the children of Israel, the Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your brethren, him you shall hear. So there Moses, speaking in Deuteronomy 18, foretold of a prophet like him, of the caliber of Moses, that brings new change, new beginnings, a new kingdom, a new nation, a prophet likened unto me, and him you shall hear. So God, so who's the one that's really blaspheming Moses? Who's the one that's really not respecting the words of Moses? It wasn't Stephen. Stephen's quoting Moses. I'm upholding the words of Moses. But also, a prophet likened unto him, well, that would mean that initially, at first, he's not going to be readily accepted. Just like Moses wasn't. It was like Moses. People were hard to follow along. And even after they started following him, we learn next in the story, that they turned back in their hearts to Egypt. wondering if they made a mistake in following Moses. And so in very like manner, Jesus, like Moses, would have individuals that just aren't sure about following him. And God said, he's a prophet, though, that you need to hear. Him you shall hear. Again, not a mistake that Stephen puts this in his lesson as well. Verse 38, this is he who was in the congregation in the wilderness with the angel who spoke to him on Mount Sinai, and with our fathers, the one who received the living oracles to give to us. They're living oracles because if you keep them, you shall live, God said. Blessed is the one who does these, for they shall live. Verse 39, whom our fathers would not obey, but rejected. And in their hearts they turned back to Egypt, saying to Aaron, make us gods to go before us. As for this Molech, Moses, who has brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. And they made a calf in those days, offered sacrifices to idols, and rejoiced in the works of their hands. How sad. Even after all those mighty works, all those signs and wonders, the plagues in the land of Egypt, the Red Sea parting, still after all that, after 40 days, Moses being on the mountain 40 days, they say, surely he's dead. We need to go a new way. Aaron, make us a golden calf. And so they did. They turned then their hearts back to Egypt. One of the reasons why it was a golden calf is because that was worshipped in Egypt. And they say not too far from that location was actually a temple to a calf, not too far from Mount Sinai. And so here they are, turning in their hearts back to Egypt. And God was greatly displeased. They rejected Moses. One thing we see is that whenever there was a time for change, God's people didn't accept it. Rather, they fought against it. And we're not talking about change for change's sake. We're talking about God-ordained change. God had planned this, had foretold it, and when the time came for it to happen, they didn't want it. Well, in like manner, the same with Jesus Christ. And that's why he talked about Isaiah 53, the suffering servant. He's going to be rejected and despised by many. And so that happens. But that wasn't the end of the story. Right, the church was built by Christ. It begins to grow, and they fight against it still because they don't want to change. These people didn't want to leave Egypt. Now, many hundreds of years later, well over 1,000 years, now they are a Jewish nation in Palestine, and they don't want to change again. And so we see a obstinate and rejecting heart of God's will time and again. Not of Stephen, but of those that were fighting against him. Comments, thoughts? All right. So what we see next is Stephen mentioned that this was not just a one-time kind of thing, right? Yes, at that particular occasion, they repent, even though some do not, and they're killed. But by and large, this was the story of the Israelite nation. Verse 42, God turned and gave them up to worship the host of heaven, as is written in the book of the prophets. Did you offer me slaughtered animals and sacrifice during 40 years in the wilderness, O house of Israel? You also took up the tabernacle of Molech, the star of your god Rephanim, images which you made to worship, and I will carry you away beyond Babylon. So even the prophets, like Amos, said, this is something that I saw in my day. This is something that God's people just kept going back to. They'd bounce back like a ping pong ball. And eventually God says, enough's enough. You're going to Babylon. You're going to captivity. So many individuals just did not want to receive the ruler and deliverer of God's people and would turn against him. Well, verse 44, our fathers had the tabernacle of witness in the wilderness, as he appointed instructing Moses to make it according to the pattern that he has seen, which our fathers, having received it in turn, also brought with Joshua into the land by the Gentiles, or possessed by the Gentiles, whom God drove out before the face of our fathers until the days of David. So let's stop right there. So far, Stephen has done a good job in showing that he does respect Moses. That one of the accusations was that he was blaspheming Moses. He shows that he does respect the law. One of the accusations was that he blasphemed the law. But here we see him both upholding the story of Moses, quoting from Moses, and talking about the law, and talking about those that didn't respect the law, but rather worshiped idols, and said that they were due the punishment God gave them. So he's answered those charges. He's also slowly answered the charges about not respecting the holy place, or the tabernacle or temple made by God. And now we'll see him directly begin to answer those charges, showing that just because God has a tent or a domicile in which he's chosen to let his glory be seen, doesn't mean then he's not glorified in other places. In fact, the tabernacle, he says in verse 44 and 45, it was taken all throughout the wilderness. So every time it was moved from place to place, there was then another holy place, right? On and on one would go until eventually it's brought into to Palestine. So he's doing a great job in showing how it's not disrespectful to say that there could potentially be another place where you can worship God, serve God, and it'd be a holy place. That had happened in the past. Every time the tabernacle moved, there was another holy place where they moved to next. So verse 46, it speaks of David who found favor before God, who asked to find a dwelling for the God of Jacob. But Solomon built him a house. However, the Most High does not dwell in the temples made with hands, as the prophet says. So eventually God does ask for a permanent location, which is the temple, which is part of the debate and discussion against Stephen. However, he said, the very one that built this temple, that very one said these words, "Heaven is my throne," verse 49, "and earth is my footstool. What house will you build for me?" says the Lord. "What is the place of my rest? Has my hand not made all these things?" And notice, no one accused Solomon of blasphemy, because Solomon understood the reality is that God is high above the earth, and that these places were temporary places for him to show his glory, to show how he is set apart and separate from sinners, and that he has made a way of reconciliation through blood where one can approach God again. So all these were shadows. They were just copies of things to come, of Jesus Christ and of the church. And so we do see Stephen building his case, and he's really going to bring it home in verse 51 and following. You might want to take a little time to think about the word stiff-necked and uncircumcised. Because I think those terms were not chosen by accident. I don't think that they were just cocked and fired right away. But that there was wisdom and forethought in using those very words in talking with his audience. Okay, I'm out of time. So mark your place there at Acts chapter 7, and we'll pick up, Lord willing, on Sunday. Thank you everybody for your comments.